34. Paris, France, January 21, 1783, day. Thomas Jefferson never reaches Paris. Foul winter weather prevents the Virginian from making the 25-day sail across the Atlantic. Nonetheless, he has re-engaged with public life. Therefore, John Jay, U.S. Ambassador to Spain, and John Adams, Ambassador to Holland, have traveled to the French capital to assist in negotiating the end of the war. But it is the tireless Benjamin Franklin, now in his 8th year as America's diplomat in Paris, who leads the way through the labyrinthine peace talks. 2 years ago, Franklin was sharply critical of the prickly Adams' confrontational negotiating style, but their time together has been restorative for the two signers of the Declaration of Independence. The past few months have seen a return of their friendship. Footnote: the American delegation was to have numbered 5 men. In addition to Franklin, Adams, Jay, and the waylaid Jefferson, Henry Laurens of South Carolina was unable to attend due to ill health after spending a year imprisoned in the Tower of London. Laurens was captured at sea by a British warship. He was released in a prisoner exchange with General Cornwallis 3 months after the Battle of Yorktown. End footnote. It has taken almost a year for the specifics of the treaty to be worked out, but now Franklin pens a historical letter to Congress. The preliminaries of peace between France, Spain, and England were yesterday signed, and a cessation of arms agreed to by the ministers of those powers and by us in behalf of the United States. I congratulate you and our country on the happy prospects afforded us by the finishing so speedily this glorious revolution. Footnote: America and Great Britain signed a separate preliminary peace treaty on November 30, 1782. This document did not include the other powers involved in the war, and thus did not guarantee a cessation of fighting. End footnote. It is Valentine's Day in London as King George finally admits defeat. Despite a series of surprising British naval victories against the French in the West Indies that could prolong the war, the king bows to public pressure and issues a proclamation calling for an end to the fighting. "We do hereby strictly charge and command all our officers, both at sea and land, and all other our subjects whatsoever, to forbear all acts of hostility, either by sea or land, against the United States of America." 2 months later, the Continental Congress meets in Philadelphia to discuss the news from Europe concerning peace. A resolution is put forth requesting whether it be our will and pleasure that the cessation of hostilities between the United States of America and His Britannic Majesty should be conformable. The measure goes on to state, "We hereby strictly charge and command all our officers, both by sea and land, and other subjects of these United States, to forbear all acts of hostility, either by sea or land, against His Britannic Majesty or his subjects." The motion passes by a unanimous vote. April 19, 1783, will mark 8 long years to the day since the Revolutionary War began in Lexington and Concord, Massachusetts. George Washington is now 51. The war has aged him. He is well over 200 pounds, far from the lean, athletic horseman he was in the years prior to taking command. He has grown weary of the pressures of command and longs to return to Mount Vernon, where Martha has been ill with ongoing abdominal problems. There is also the matter of recapturing his many slaves, who either ran off during the war or took refuge with the British. Yet those matters, while pressing, do not preoccupy the general's mind today. Instead, he writes a letter from his headquarters in Newburgh, New York, where he has spent the last year. Washington has written thousands of letters over the course of the war, but none as wondrous as the missive he now composes. Directed by Congress to formally declare the end of fighting to his men, His Excellency allows his innermost emotions to flow onto the page. "The Commander-in-Chief orders the cessation of hostilities between the United States of America and the King of Britain," he begins. "The Commander-in-Chief, far from endeavoring to stifle the feeling of joy in his own bosom, offers his most cordial congratulations on the occasion to all the officers of every denomination, to all the troops of the United States in general, and in particular to those gallant and persevering men who had resolved to defend the invaded rights of their country so long as the war should continue. He then orders that the letter be read aloud on the anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord to every regiment and brigade in the Continental Army. He also orders a reward. An extra ration of liquor is to be issued to every man tomorrow to drink to perpetual peace, independence, and happiness to the United States of America. The successful treaty that Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and John Jay cobbled together now means that America officially extends as far west as the Mississippi River, and that the fishermen of New England have unlimited access to the thriving Canadian fishing waters. More important, the Treaty of Paris can best be summed up in the opening sentence, a string of once heretical words first suggested by the pen of Thomas Jefferson in 1776. His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States, Article 1 begins, to be free, sovereign, and independent states, that he treats with them as such, and for himself, his heirs and successors, relinquishes all claims to the government, propriety, and territorial rights of the same and every part thereof. With that sentence, the American War of Independence is over.